We do not have a quorum, and we're a little rushed for time today, and so we're going to hear House File 2895, and it's only being held for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. Do you have an amendment there, too?
Yes, we do.
All right. If you just throw that on, even, you know, or later on when you have a quorum, remember to do it.
Okay. I would. Why don't you just describe it?
Right. We'll describe the amendment, too. I mean, the amendment just fills in, and you've all got it, some numbers is really what it is at this point. But I'll turn it over. I have people here from Candiota County Human Services and from Atwater, from one of the facilities that we're talking about here, to provide testimony and information for you. And since they speak your language and I don't, I'm going to let them talk. So.
Over to the microphone.
Chairperson Huntley and committee members, my name is Catherine Johnson. I am the administrator of Presbyterian Family Foundation's Atwater House, which is an intermediate care facility for persons with mental retardation-related conditions. And I support Bill 2895. My ICFMR, our ICFMR, as they are called with the acronym, is in serious peril. With the unallotment of the variable rate funding mechanism, we are looking at closure. I was here in 2005 to ask for a rate adjustment because our rate that we receive for a daily rate for the people that live there is so low. It's $122.43 a day, and we cannot make it on that. So I came to ask to see if we could have our rate recalculated, and it did not pass. It did not work out. So I thought at that time that possibly we were faced with closure, but we were lucky enough to tap into the variable rate funding mechanism, which provides money for people based on their needs and provides money above and beyond the daily rate. And so we have utilized that since 2006. With the unallotment facing us on July 1st of 2011, we will lose roughly one-third of our income. No business can survive with a loss of one-third of the revenue. We will be forced to close, and the people who live there, Ruth, Diane, Linda, and Maria, the new kid, who's been there the shortest amount of time, has lived in the house for 15 years. The person who has lived there the longest has been there 22 years. The women range in age from 46 years old to 84 years old. They have become a family in their home. I would certainly hate to have to close and wonder where they're going to go to live. Atwater is a small community in rural Minnesota. We have 11 staff who live in the community. We are one of the largest employers in Atwater, along with the day training program that serves our folks. And we have accounts at the local grocery store, the hardware store. We frequent the cafes. We get gas. Certainly, we are a major part of that community, and we are accepted and well thought of in the community as both an employer and a vital part of the community of Atwater. And what we are offering with this bill is a bridge, a year's amount of money to support us and keep us open and keep their place to live for another year. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I do have some brief comments from the human service person out there, too.
My name is Tamara Goldenstein, and Chair Huntley and committee members, I really appreciate this opportunity that you've given us today to talk with you. I am a social service supervisor for Candiota High County Family Services. One of my areas that I am responsible for is the provision of intermediate care facility services in Candiota High County. Today I'm testifying on the behalf of the county, PFF, and the residents of that facility. One of the things I really want to emphasize is one of our roles is to ensure the core value of the services for persons with disabilities is provided, and that is choice and self-determination. As Kathy has said, these individuals have over each and every year emphasized their choice is to live in this ICFMR. These are not individuals that are there because they can't get an allocation or move out to the community. And that information has been on file with the Department of Human Services every year. Also, this is a community that has embraced these individuals. They've integrated them into the community and made them community members. As Kathy said, this community, a very small rural community, is very dependent on this facility in terms of its economic well-being. And again, when that choice leaves, on 7-1 of 2010. It's very important to know that the role the county has as the local service needs determination provider as the lead agency, we have certain reasons why we can close a facility that DHS provides us. None of those reasons exist except for the simple fact that the funding is not adequate to support those individuals' needs. Those individuals' needs have been determined to be at that level up with the variable rate by the Department of Human Services since 2005. As any business, there isn't a business that can go 12 months with one-third less revenue. We are in a situation where I'm going to need to go to my county board and ask for closure of a facility that we do not want to close. The residents do not want to close. The community does not want to close. And it makes absolutely no sense in the current parameters of which you would close an ICFMR facility. The only option we have then is to move those individuals to the developmental disabilities waiver. When I look at the cost analysis for that, it actually will incur more of a cost to the state of Minnesota than it will if you would continue to provide services than an ICFMR with a variable rate instituted. In fact, substantially more over a period of time, basically negating the savings that would occur from the unallotment of the vulnerable rate. So I appreciate your opportunities today, and I hope you would support House File 2895.
And Representative Junkie, the fiscal amount would be 182 in 2010 and 700 in 2011.
Mr. Chair, that fiscal note is for a broader group of homes than just mine.
Okay.
Prepared, but talking to your staff, if we're looking at just this facility, it's future tails are like 87,000 rather than the 700. So I do have. I have a couple options for you we can talk about as and if it moves forward.
Okay. And any questions? Representative Teasley.
Just quickly, so do we know how many others there are?
I know the department is here, too, that works on that.
Oh, I can talk to them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anybody from the department wishes to...
They're all excited to come down and talk to you, Mr. Chair.
He asked that it's supposed to know how many other homes of this support.
So,
you tell him.
Yeah.
You're the expert.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I would estimate there are approximately 70 other homes that are receiving variable rate funding that will expire July 1st, 2011.
Could you state your name for the record?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Glenn Smith, Department of Human Services.
And could you repeat the number?
There are approximately 70 other facilities that are receiving variable rate funding that will expire.
For all or part of their occupants, right? Is there
correct. A, yeah. That's correct.
And, thank you. Representative Junkie, this is related to an unallotment that's supposed to start on July 1?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
and again, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you're ratifying those unallotments or if that's part of your discussion, I assume, going forward as to what to do with those, and that's why we thought we'd bring the issue to you. Now, that is one of those unallotments that if we ratify it within your budget, this is the result.
Okay, well, thank you for bringing it to our attention, and we're in the process of working on our budget, and when we get a quorum, I will move that this be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill, and we'll probably have you come in and testify again.
Good. All right, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you, members.
And Representative Murphy, again, we do not have a quorum, although we're getting close. One, two, three, four, five, seven. What do we need? Nine. Oh, what have we got? Okay, Representative Murphy, if you want to start explaining
Hi, Mr. Chair.
What's happened since the veto override.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I am here to talk with you today about House File 802, which is the legislation on general assistance medical care and our efforts to bring a solution forward to the veto that happened last May. And I know Representative Dean is going to be coming, and he's going to probably join me up here. We've done a lot of work together in the past months. And
if I could just interrupt for a minute, we have a quorum now, so I will call the meeting to order, and we have a couple of minutes someplace. For what dates? March 4 and March 5. And
can I?
Go ahead.
Representative Thiessen checked the spelling of his name and moves that we adopt the minutes. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So we've adopted the minutes. And let me do, for those of you who came late, we heard a 2895 bill from Representative Junkie relates to ICFMRs. Some ICFMRs get paid a daily rate for all their patients. Others get paid a variable rate based on the severity of the disability. And he is requesting that we do not unallot the variable rate money, or the governor's proposed that we unallot the governor or the variable rate money starting July 1 of this year. And so I will move, first of all, that House File 2895 be recommended to pass.
Don't I have to do that first?
Yeah, and then recommend for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. And then we would have to, we have a delete all amendment, the DE1. I would move that we approve the DE1 amendment. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 And
what did you say? It was 70 facilities?
Mm-hmm. The fiscal note is $182,000 in 2010 and $700,000 in 2011. That represents the variable rates for about 70 facilities. And again, they had testimony from a particular ICFMR that's affected by this, and it would have reduced their revenues by one-third, and they would have to close. So I would move that we lay this over for possible inclusion in the finance bill, and we'll have another hearing when we start really discussing the details of the finance bill. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the 2895 as amended is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And now, Representative Murphy, you can continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 802. Be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Representative Murphy moves the 802 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. And do you have an amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair. The 802A3-2.
Dash 2? Where is that one? Okay. Oh, okay. So she's moving the DE31 amendment, which
That would be right.
Which is a delete all. So it gets the bill in the way she wants it. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The DE31 delete all amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I have the A32.
Representative Murphy moves the A32 amendment to the delete all amendment. And would you describe what's in the A32?
This, Mr. Chair, adds chiropractic and podiatric services back to the list of benefits covered in general assistance medical care. It adds language to make sure that we know what to do with the drug pool that is a part of this proposal if it starts to run low on cash. And it makes some changes to the appropriations.
Okay, all those in favor of the A32 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A lot has happened since the day that we worked to or tried to override the governor's veto on this proposal. And without going into a lot of discussion about the last couple of weeks, I actually think in this case the effort to override the veto brought into sharp relief the House's concerns, the concerns by the House of Representatives on the issue of auto enrollment and its costs, and it brought people back to the table in a more effective way. And I think that in the end, is probably one of the things that helped us move in the direction that we are now. The language that you're looking at in the proposal looks familiar because it is built upon the work that we've already done over the last 9 months, and it looks a lot like the bill that you've already voted for, with some significant changes. In the bill that we've already voted for, we had a county provider partnership. And we have taken that concept, which was voluntary in the bill, and we have built upon that, and it is referred to now as a coordinating care organization. And in the bill, we envision that the top 17 hospitals that provide care for the about 80% of those being served in DAMC would take on the responsibility of being a coordinating care organization, also known as a CCO, without the W. We have talked since 2007 and 2008 about the idea of working with vulnerable and sick populations and coordinating their care to get better outcomes for those getting the care and a better value for the dollar that we spend. And that premise is embedded in this idea. In 2007 and 2008, when we talked about those ideas, people were pretty worried about them. We moved forward with the idea of a healthcare home, and that's moved through the regulatory process and is going to be launched. But in 2008, we weren't ready to tackle the idea of global payments for care to organizations. We called it back then level 3 and total cost of care. But I think numbers of people in the legislature and now the administration is more interested in that idea. And so we're going to try that here. To balance the needs of the enrollees, to make sure that they have access to care across the state, we've also created an uncompensated care pool for 6 months to give those hospitals that don't serve the majority of the population, who may serve a very small part of the population, the opportunity to consider creating partnerships and becoming a CCO, again, so that they can participate in the coordination of care for the population being served. They have that choice, and they have 6 months to figure that out. And until then, there's an uncompensated care pool. It was important from our perspective to make sure that there was coverage across the state. And we have essentially done that with the exception of some outpatient payments for people who live in the part of the state who aren't served by CCOs. And that's something we're going to have to pay attention to and monitor because it is a gap in the model as we have now. The other significant change in this proposal versus the one that we voted for a while ago is the amount of funding. This bill is significantly underfunded from my perspective. That would be my perspective. Others would think and look at it in another way. The bill that we passed cost about $281 million. The price tag for this bill is $164 million. That's a difference of about $117 million. And I think that's significant, and I think we're going to have to pay attention to the care delivered and to the experience of the enrollees as we go forward. So while I have before you a proposal that I hope you'll support, because I think it is better than not passing this bill, we have a lot of work to do, I think, together to make sure what we're proposing is going to be effective. And I think we're going to have to continue to evaluate and amend and improve on this model. General assistance medical care as a program is intact. It does have changes to it, but there is a benefit set, eligibility and an opportunity for people to enroll. Minnesota Care remains solvent, protecting the Health Care Access Fund and health care coverage for working Minnesotans, which is another one of the goals that's been important to me. And there is reform embedded in this proposal. And as I've described that, it's something that we started discussing a long time ago. And while I am worried that it is underfunded in this proposal, I do think it is a reform that Minnesota should consider going forward. And so I'm hopeful that it will yield a good benefit. With this bill, we're asking a lot of Minnesotans. We're asking a lot of providers. We're asking a lot of advocates. We're asking a lot of the enrollees. The reform and the timeline around this reform is intense. And as I said, I think it's underfunded. We're counting on providers and advocates to help us with an ongoing evaluation of the care provided. And I think this is an area of the model that will need more attention as we go forward. But most importantly for me, for those living in the shadows, we have affirmed that they have a place in Minnesota, and we're not going to abandon them. So I ask for your support. Wow. It's been a long week.
Yeah. 2 weeks.
And with that, I'll take your questions.
I think we'll go to testimony right away, and the members should understand that basically what the providers are going to get is one-third of a cup. And one-third of a cup is better than nothing. So with that, we'll move. Thank you. And we'll get back to you on questions after we hear the testimony. And where's the list? Yeah, right here. Michael Scandrett.
Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Michael Scandrett. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition. The Safety Net Coalition represents the safety net hospitals, community health centers, community mental health programs, coverage programs, and other both providers and programs that serve low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged populations. And obviously the coalition's members are the ones most affected by the legislation and most interested in the outcome of it. And I want to just say that I really appreciate what Representative Murphy and Representative Dean and others around this committee have been working on, and also appreciate the Department of Human Services and the agreement that came together. And there's so much to hate about it, but I don't think anybody that worked on it loves it. And I think the thing to remember that as you hear from everybody that's going to be feeling pain as a result of this is that it would be worse if this didn't pass. And yes, there always could have been something better if circumstances had been different, but it's important that at least something be provided. And there's a very imperfect solution. There will be a lot of issues that you're going to hear from people about. Among those issues are Safety Net Coalition members, the outpatient clinics, the community health centers, community mental health centers. There's no money directly for them in the bill. And there is money for the hospitals to serve the population. We know that's the case, and we know that those outpatient services are right now keeping the cost of the hospitals down, and that those hospitals that do get that grant to be a coordinated care organization will want to and should work with those outpatient services to make sure that that capacity remains in place. There's no easy answer about who should get the money and control how that works, but the Safety Net Coalition does believe that moving to a way of creating greater accountability for managing the cost more effectively is a positive step. This isn't the way we thought we would be making it, and it's happening faster than we thought it would happen, but it is what it is, and I think our members will be working very hard to try to find ways to make this all work. There are things that I think that could be improved in the bill. We're very respectful of the agreement that's been made, and we know this will be an ongoing process, and we don't want to go a step backward, but we do look forward to continuing to work with the legislature and the administration around not only this bill necessarily, but also the budget issues, because this is part of the piece of the pie. The budget is the other part of the piece of the pie, and in order to sustain those services, such as the outpatient services, we have to make sure that we're not taking a step back in the state's support for those services in the budget as well. And I think the budget discussion will be an opportunity to continue to refine some of these issues that require additional work. So again, I encourage you to support the bill and to also continue to work with the Safety Net Coalition and other stakeholders as we try to move very quickly to put something in place that will be better than what would happen if we weren't moving forward with the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I'm glad you're the first one up. This has been on my mind on this whole topic all along, having watched the success of the dance around people here.
There you are.
the quality of work your community clinics do on a dime, literally sometimes. I guess you get 8 cents, or hopefully you could do as well as that. But I hope that the people managing this money at the, if it's the hospitals or whatever winds up being the coordinating care functionary, has a full appreciation that we expect that they're going to use you and all the primary care providers. And I know that just from the peripheral conversations that it's the concern of some that this is going to be a central repository to make sure one group doesn't lose some money. But it's expectation for me as I support this, and I've been hoping this could come to fruition all along, that these coordinated care organizations make heavy use of the outpatient primary care. And your clinics in particular, I understand your clinics serve some 6,000 individuals or more, and they should serve even more of them. So I just encourage you and just get some intent on record that's what I expect. And that'll hopefully serve the people that we're so concerned about.
If you go to page 25, line 8, you'll see a statement that the hospital in the CCO shall contract with essential community providers. So we did get some language in there on that. And so any other questions for Mr. Scandrett? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Scandrett. Next, we're going to hear from Billy Jo Zielinski. She's the Assistant Commissioner of Human Services. And I would, it's not aimed directly at you, but I'm kind of hoping we can get out of here at 2:30.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Billy Jo Zielinski. I am the Healthcare Administration Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. As you know, Commissioner Ludeman has been working in collaboration with legislative leaders and on his behalf and the administration. Thank Representative Murphy for her leadership on this issue and Matt Dean and others. This House File 802 is a product of that collaboration. I know the intent was to balance the needs of the vulnerable population, focusing on people and not necessarily a program, reform of the healthcare system, all while trying to bring spending down and under control. This provides coverage for approximately 30,000 Minnesotans. It spends $87 million less than the bill that was already voted for in this biennium in the general fund, and $194 million in the next biennium. In the Healthcare Access Fund, there's a $95 million was for the bill that was voted for in this bill, 802. $409 million is saved in the Healthcare Access Fund for this in the next biennium. This is a step forward in challenging times, and I think I would reiterate that it isn't perfect. This is, though, a permanent solution rather than a temporary fix for GMC individuals. And I thank you for the opportunity and urge your support for House File 802.
Questions for the Assistant Commissioner? I don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. And next we'll have Brock Nelson from Regents Hospital. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Brock Nelson, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Regents Hospital. On behalf of Regents Hospital, our 4,100 employees, and our medical staff, I am here to urge your support of this legislation. This is not a perfect solution, and we will all need to continue to work towards the issues and make it work. First, I'd like to thank the leadership for their hard work to help restore coverage for the GMC population over the last 10 months. Specifically, I would like to thank Representative Aaron Murphy, Representative Tom Huntley, Representative Matt Dean, Senator Linda Berglund, and Commissioner Cal Ludeman. I also want to thank the staff at the legislature and the Department of Human Services. I would also be remiss if I didn't recognize all of the others, including safety net providers, advocacy groups, faith-based organizations, hospitals, counties, and health plans that have stepped up to address the issue. In my over 30-year career, the elimination of GMC has easily been the greatest healthcare challenge that I've seen our state face. I would guess it might be one of the greatest challenges that you have faced in your time as a legislator. I think the agreement represents a solution to the challenge and the beginning of others, including the looming budget deficit. As of this afternoon, we haven't had the opportunity to fully understand the impact of the bill on Regents. However, it is my hope that the agreement and the proposed legislation will accomplish three main objectives. First, to maintain access to health care for the sickest of the sick and the poorest of the poor. Second, to direct resources to those hospitals that serve this population. And three, to provide a structure for hospitals to work more efficiently in coordinating the care needs of this population that will make health care become more affordable. The first point is easy for most people to support and an important part of the legislation. It's the last two points that will be a challenge. While our hospital, like other hospitals in the state, would have liked to see the same level of funding that currently exists, this bill is a better solution than what would have happened if the program was eliminated. Second, coupled with lower reimbursing, asking hospitals to change the way we provide this care of this population is a new challenge. This is uncharted waters for all of us. The next 16 months will not be easy. However, I want you to know that we work very hard and we accept this challenge ahead of us. Regents has had a long history of working with others in our community on initiatives to improve health, coordinate care, and reduce hospital use. One in particular is the Mental Health Drug Assistance Program. We will increase that work. Over the next year and a half, we'll be asking a lot of our partners to join us, and we'll be working together to make the best of this we can. I am confident that we will all rise to the challenge to provide the best care and best experience for GMC enrollees. As we begin the work of creating a new model of care, I urge all of you to continue to support this important effort. Minnesota is counting on us. I thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions for Mr. Nelson. Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just have to say to the author, I was out at a community meeting and you're now being called Saint Erin. You've probably heard that. She's been nominated for sainthood. So we're very proud of your work and what you have done. To Mr. Nelson, I just wanted to say thank you for the emails we get from you, I think, every Friday. I do pay attention to them. I do open them. And you kept us posted all the way along of how if there wasn't a compromise, it was going to affect your hospital. And I do hope you will continue to do that. There's a lot of people here that are wondering how to communicate with legislators, but I think having the CEO send out an update regularly was very effective. And appreciate your input and your involvement.
Thank you.
Other questions? I don't see any. Thank you, Mr. Brock.
Thank you.
Mr. Nelson, yeah. next is Lawrence Massa from the Hospital Association.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing our state's 147 hospitals and 17 health systems. Once again, I want to thank all of you for the opportunity to be here today and to thank you for your ongoing dedication to serving the healthcare needs of this vulnerable population and for your continued work to find a GAMC legislative fix. Needless to say, this task has not been easy. MHA strongly supported the first two bills, which we continue to believe were viable and preferable solutions to serving this population and for preserving Minnesota's healthcare infrastructure. However, we recognize that the bill before you today may be the only approach that Governor Pawlenty is willing to sign into law. As you can imagine, it is difficult to testify on a proposal as complicated as this without having sufficient time to review the legislative language in detail and to try to evaluate all of the financial as well as care delivery implications to our members. For the record, we continue to believe the initial proposal was the best for the GAMC population, the provider community, and for the overall state budget. Now let me address the new proposal. It is important to remember that the MHA board's first goal was to maintain coverage for as many Minnesotans as possible. The secondary goal was to mitigate the financial loss to hospitals that provide the care. This bill addresses both of these concerns to some degree. It provides some money for hospitals to care for GAMC patients. It patches together funding in a manner that hopefully won't require tens of thousands of working adults on MinnesotaCare to lose their health insurance. And it recognizes that hospitals and health systems will move to more population-driven health delivery in the future. However, we believe it will also significantly increase hospitals' uncompensated care and will lead to higher health insurance premiums in the private sector. I'd like to make some specific comments about the proposal based on the review that we've been able to do so far. In total, hospitals will receive approximately $91 million in payments for the total cost of care for this population, compared to the $219 million they would have received under the former GAMC program for just the hospital-provided care. That represents about 41% of our previous payment levels, accompanied with enormous risk and responsibilities associated with the total cost of caring for this population. Contracting with the Department of Human Services to be a coordinator or a care coordinating organization will be a difficult undertaking. The services required are predetermined. The hospital has no control over the number of enrollees assigned to it, and hospitals are not assured about the amount of money the CCOs is to be paid. If hospitals are allowed to become continuing or care coordination organizations in phases, with some initially joining in June and others at a later date, the amount of money a hospital receives will drop as more organizations join. How can a hospital plan care delivery not knowing what resources will be available to them for their various provider contracts if the amount of money they are to receive continues to change as more organizations become care coordinating organizations? Likewise, for other hospitals that choose not to become care coordinating organizations, the amount of money they will receive out of the uncompensated care pool will greatly vary based on how many hospitals choose this option, and that money runs out on November 30. In addition to the underfunding, all of the risks and unknowns discussed above, CCOs have to pay the state for their proportional share of 20% of the state's prescription drug pool. If the drug pool is about $56 million, then the CCOs will have to collectively pay about $11 million out of the $71 million that they're allocated for this purpose. This seems like a very unfair provision and could dissuade some hospitals from opting to become a care coordination organization. The negotiated deal asks an awful lot for Minnesota's hospitals that are already struggling to meet the demands of more and more public program patients. It asks hospitals to take on more financial risk for less money, and it puts most of the financial and organizational responsibility on hospitals without sharing the burden more fairly with health plans, counties, and other stakeholders. That being said, I want to assure you that Minnesota's hospitals have always been and will continue to be committed to meeting the needs of our patients and our communities with whatever resources we have. Let me conclude by asking you to look at what comes next, the state budget. If this bill passes, then please don't treat this particular piece of legislation like ancient history when looking at the governor's proposed budget cuts. These proposed budget cuts, which include Medicaid rate cuts, medical education cuts, MinnesotaCare enrollment cuts, disproportionate share hospitals cuts, rural hospital DRG add-on cuts, would be devastating for our healthcare system. When putting together your budget, please recognize that hospitals are already doing more than our fair share to preserve Minnesota's safety net. We still have a lot of questions about this legislation and how it will work, but we thank you for the opportunity to share these initial thoughts and reactions with you. And once again, thank you for your continued attention to this important issue. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Mr. Massa? Well, I don't see anything, and I agree with everything you said. This is certainly not an adequate bill, but it's the best we could get. And I would also say that if there's one time that hospitals, community clinics, and county social workers need to work together, it's on this population. They just can't separate the social service needs from their health care needs. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Dave Renner, MMA.
Mr. Chair and members, Dave Renner with the Minnesota Medical Association. I think you're going to hear a lot of the same throughout most of the testimony today. A lot of people saying thank you for your hard work because this has been a difficult issue that many of you have worked on for many months. And a lot of us saying there's a lot of problems with this, but we understand the realities and that this is better than doing nothing. And that's, in a sense, the message I have as well. We would continue to believe that if we are want to continue to push for the goals of true health system reform and bending the health care cost curve, it is crucial that we continue to provide coverage for all Minnesotans. And we believe that this is moving in the wrong direction to that, but because of that, we think that we have to support this legislation to be able to at least keep the program going and continue to provide coverage. As you all know, earlier this year we raised significant concerns about the size of the provider payment cuts. We continue to have those concerns in this bill for at least the 2 months for which outpatient providers can still bill. We're looking at 63% cuts in payments. Those are on top of payments that currently are about 37% of what the private sector pays for outpatient services. We continue to fear that this is going to have some financial hardships and start to put our entire safety net at risk. But as I said earlier, I think failing to continue this program and provide coverage is not an option. So we are appreciative of at least something moving forward. This does maintain coverage for the lowest income-earning Minnesotans without premium structures, which we believe would have been barriers for those getting coverage. And as importantly, it also protects the Health Care Access Fund. Earlier proposals would have significantly put the Access Fund at risk, not only dismantling potentially the General Assistance Program, General Assistance Medical Care Program, but also the Minnesota Care Program. So we think those are both positives here. Again, I think everybody's well aware of this, but just remember for physician clinics who are practicing outside of the areas where CCOs will be, there will be no coverage for those services. The only coverage that in this bill is for 6 months in the hospital uncompensated care pool. That seems to go the exact opposite direction that you all, in the health reforms that we passed in 2008. The focus of those reforms was trying to get people out of hospitals, trying to provide more preventive coverage and coverage to care coordination. We think this is going in the opposite direction of that. We continue to be strong supporters of health system reforms designed to change our payment systems, and things like accountable care organizations and care coordination concepts have merit, and we are strong supporters of those. I want to caution you, however, to not refer to this bill as reform. We do not believe this bill is reform. We believe this bill is nothing more than cutting payments, basically getting block grants to hospitals and saying, you absorb the costs, you accept the risks. We do not believe that this will allow the innovation that's necessary under some of our the accountable care organization idea. So I don't want people judging whether those are successful or not based on how this program works. You all are well aware that the solution is far from perfect. We are once again are asking providers to absorb more and more costs without providing adequate payment. And I just caution you that that cannot continue forever. Echoing Mr. Moss's comments, as we are now facing trying to address the $1 billion that you still have to balance, we would hope that this doesn't you don't begin to turn to providers and ask for further cuts, because we are truly concerned that our safety net may begin unraveling. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Renner? I don't see any. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Maureen O'Connell.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maureen O'Connell, and I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, and with me today is Patrick Ness from the Office of Social Justice, and he's going to start off our testimony.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
May I have you say your name for
yes,
the tape?
Yes, Patrick Ness, Public Policy Manager, Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, and a member of the Save GMC Coalition. Our coalition brings together a broad base of GMC enrollees, consumer and low-income advocates, labor and faith groups, providers, social service organizations, and others who care very deeply about the pending elimination of general assistance medical care since May. Our number one goal has always been to protect the eligibility and benefit set of those struggling to survive. Here's what we've done. Over the last 9 months, we've engaged over 10,000 Minnesotans in the fight to save healthcare for this program. People on GMC have been here for the first time usually and had their voice heard in churches, synagogues across the state. We've raised this issue. And it's difficult to sit here today and know that the will of Minnesotans it's not being met with this bill, unfortunately. But I want to say before we move on just how much sincerely we appreciate the leadership of Representative Murphy and other members who have put considerable time into this bill. It has been an uphill climb. So often we've had to come back to the table, and we have this after the 125-9 vote. There seemed to be a thawing on this issue, and then it refroze, and then it has come back to us again. And in this time of spring, as everything is kind of melting away, we're realizing that there's a lot of potholes left on the streets and on this road to health care for folks, and it's going to be a very, very bumpy road moving forward. We're optimistic coming out of Friday's agreement. We celebrated when we learned of the coverage. We do believe in the reform, and we support moving forward with alternative care models, but would also echo Mr. Renner that we would caution against trumpeting this as reform. Reform does take investment. We think there's some really good ideas in this bill, but that does take investment that is not in this legislation. So overall, before we move on to Ms. O'Connell, we do feel that this language, as currently stands, leaves far too little security for the men and women that are supposed to receive health care coverage, and Ms. O'Connell can get into the details. But we thank you for your work, and we do believe that this bill is probably better than nothing.
Thank you. Ms. O'Connell.
As Patrick has indicated, from an enrollee perspective, we are particularly looking at the bill from an eligibility and service perspective, but we do want to acknowledge the deep provider rate cuts, and we recognize that rate cuts do affect access, and but we think that your committee will hear a lot more from other people about the rate cuts. So we're going to focus on two things, eligibility and services. And under the bill, the good news is that eligibility is preserved. And we would like to point out that while we view transitional Minnesota care and the loss of it under this version of the bill as a loss in eligibility, we recognize that if the trade-off was that we have a GMC program, we think that is a good trade-off. So the good news is that you're eligible. The bad news from an enrollee standpoint is we have to ask the question, what are you eligible for? And for enrollees, first, it will depend on where you live and if a CCO is even possible in your area. Second, if a CCO is possible, the hospital must choose to be a CCO. And if your hospital chooses to be a CCO, then it depends on what benefits that the CCO chooses to provide. And with regard to the benefits that we are particularly concerned about the language on page 24, lines 6 through 8, and I'll just quickly read it, a set of comprehensive and medically necessary health services that the recipients might reasonably require to be maintained in good health. We don't know what that means when you're talking about a population that is chronically ill. So we're very concerned about that language and would like to continue to work on that as perhaps the budget bills go forward. On that note, the other issue that we'd like to point out, as the budget work continues on, we'd like to point out that many of the GMC enrollees are also on general assistance. And under the governor's proposal, their cash assistance will be eliminated. We urge you to not adopt that the governor's general assistance elimination and to allow them to continue to have the 2003, given the uncertainty of their health care. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Ness or Ms. O'Connell? I don't see any. Thank you very much. And next we have Buck McAlpine, North Memorial Hospital.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Buck McAlpine, Director of Government Affairs for North Memorial Hospital and Ambulance Operations. We come forward to say we support this proposal, as you folks have worked very hard to put it together. I won't repeat a lot of what Mr. Nelson commented on, but very similar issues that we have as we move it forward. We start already tomorrow morning meeting at 7 a.m. over how we're going to put a model together like this. Obviously, we're within Hennepin County, one of four or five hospitals where there's a large population of GAMC patients, and we felt it was important that we went ahead with a model like this and worked with the other hospitals in the county who we believe will do the same thing and try to coordinate some of this care. As you know, there's about 120,000 ambulance calls in Hennepin County, and that's a significant amount of this work too. And we thought we had to work as a system to decide how we move these patients back and forth to be sure that we give them optimum care. So although it's not the best version, when you take this much money out of it, we feel that as of today we had nothing, and anything that we get to support this population is greatly appreciated, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. McAlpine? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Next is Sue Abderholden from NAMI. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. First, you know, we really do want to thank Representative Murphy and Dean for their hard work on putting this proposal together. We know that this was not easy. I want to start out by saying that thanks to the 2007 mental health investments, you know, the $34 million, that in fact that was supposed to transform our system, and that work has actually begun. We have services that we didn't have before. We're starting to develop an infrastructure for our mental health system. And I just want to point out that I use the word it's begun. It hasn't been completed. And what NAMI is really concerned about is that when you take this bill and the other items in the governor's budget, that we're really going to derail those efforts. We are concerned that the new CCOs won't work with some of the mental health providers. We have three services in particular that are funded under GAMC, adult rehab mental health services, crisis homes, and intensive residential treatment services. we're just really unsure at this point whether those will continue to be funded. And some of those programs, the crisis homes, some of them have 50% of their funding from GAMC. Some of the ERTs are 25% to 30%. And those are actually, you know, far cheaper than using hospitalization. I think that the other thing is to think about this kind of in the big picture with the other items in the governor's budget. So when you take the loss of funding for those particular mental health programs, then you take the $7.9 million that's in the bill that is away from adult mental health services, then you take the $17 million from state-operated services, we actually get dangerously close to the $34 million that you gave us on our system in 2007. So we're just really concerned about how this is all really going to play out. And it's really hard to track what will happen to a lot of the folks that we care about. The other thing that I would just add is that over and over again this year, whether you're talking about this particular bill or the state-operated services proposal that you'll probably hear about next week, that we use words like, you know, accountability, better outcomes, transformation, and reform. But I guess we would just really like to say that we wish you wouldn't use those words, that really what we're trying to do is to make do and do the best that we can with kind of devastating financial situation. And so it's not really, the state-operated services is not reform or transformation. You really can't transform and support a system with that much less money. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Abderholden? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Next is James Hadigan from Gillette Children's. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Hunley. I'll try to keep my comments very brief. As you know, my name is James Hadigan. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. Gillette was originally started as a state hospital over 100 years ago, and then 20 years ago became a private, non-for-profit organization. Our mission when the state founded us, and is still our mission, is to deal with profoundly disabling conditions for children. That's a mission and a partnership we feel we still have with the state. Like all of you, I wish the budget issues that's facing us didn't leave us having to make some of these hard choices. On behalf of Gillette, I want to commend you for your hard work in putting together a bill that will continue to provide essential medical services for those among us who need this help the most. Now, as a pediatric hospital, Gillette actually has very few GAMC patients, in some years no patients. However, we believe this bill is too important not to pass, and so we do support its passage. Now, however, I would be remiss in my duties as Chief Financial Officer if I did not share with you that this bill does have some adverse financial impacts on Gillette. The bill is funded by using what is commonly referred to as the quarterly dish payments. These payments help to relieve some of the financial hardship on high dish hospitals such as Gillette, and we receive $1.8 million annually from that. We will lose that funding in this bill, and again, because we're a pediatric hospital and GAMC is primarily an adult program, we will not see any offsetting revenue. 50% of our patients are covered by Medicaid, which is more than five times the Minnesota hospital average, and that reimbursement for Medicaid over the last 7 years has been falling significantly. As you can see on the second page of my handout, the losses have roughly doubled every 2 years. In 2002, this program pretty much paid the cost for these patients. In 2010, it will pay just a little more than half of the cost of caring for these patients. In conclusion, I want to say again that Gillette does support the passage of this bill. We think it's the right thing to do. But I will leave you with only one simple request. As you move forward with your work on this bill and on other budget issues in the coming weeks, I ask that you keep Gillette in mind.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Hadigan. Next is Mary Edwards from Fairview Hospitals and Clinics. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Representative Huntley and committee members. I'm Mary Edwards. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy for Fairview Health Services. The Fairview system includes 7 hospitals across the greater metro area, including Hibbing and Red Wing. I'm speaking on behalf of all Fairview hospitals and clinics when I say thank you, Representative Huntley. Representative Murphy, my longtime friend, I thank you very much for all your work. And Representative Dean and other legislative leaders and members of the Pawlenty administration who worked very hard to create a new GAMC proposal. From the beginning of the situation, Fairview has advocated for the restoration of GAMC for the good of the people served by the program, for the protection of the key healthcare safety net. Given the circumstances and alternatives, we are supportive of this proposal. Because of the proposal's rapid development, my feedback today is based on general concepts from what we understand about the bill that we received last night. Having said that, we support the bill based on the following 3 reasons. Number 1, it is good for the patients. Individuals covered by GAMC, including those that utilize our mental health and chemical dependency services at the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview, are best served by a program that continues as much as the fashion that it has before. Just for your information, Fairview Health Services is the largest region's hospital for comprehensive chemical dependency and mental health in the Upper Midwest. Many of these programs are provided at UMMC Fairview. Number 2, why this is, we will support this proposal. It provides access to primary care and prescription drugs. The best hope of reducing costs in this program is getting people covered by GAMC better aligned with their primary care services. And prescriptions are absolutely vital for improving and maintaining this population's health. Number 3, it's an interesting proposal. Interesting is always an interesting word. Fairview has been working very hard over the last 2 years to create new models of care. We aim to improve quality, improve patient experience, and reduce the total cost of care. The current proposal would provide incentives to rapidly develop a care model for this population. The social and physical and emotional needs of a GAMC enrollees requires a very unique care model. The timing, however, is going to be very challenging since the bill calls for coordinated care delivery organizations to start by June 1st of this year. While we're supportive of this proposal, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention some of our concerns. The proposed caps on the state's financial responsibility for health needs of this population caps that responsibility. However, hospitals don't have that option. Anytime you squeeze $400 million into a $165 million budget, something has to give. In this situation, it's hospitals that will have to give. We will give more uncompensated care. We will give the care for which we'll be paid even less than before. In addition, it appears there may be many new administrative requirements that will add time and expense. For example, the bill states that hospitals will have to submit invoices in order to get reimbursement from the uncompensated care pool. And also, the CCO part of it, the hospitals and the coordinated care will likely have to negotiate with provider contractors with non-employed physician groups. This is going to be an interesting challenge. So our concerns remain about the financial structure and financial risk of the proposal, yet we feel we must support this effort. Some version of a GAMC program is far better than no version, the looming alternative. I think it's important to remember that a pessimist sees the difficulty in every opportunity. An optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. Thank you.
Questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Edwards. Next is Scott Lights, and after him will be Mike Mahoney.
And then Ron Brown.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lights.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Scott Lights, and I'm Public Policy Director at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. I first want to start by thanking Representative Murphy, Representative Dean, and others who were involved in coming up with this compromise solution to the GAMC dilemma. We recognize that these were not easy discussions. We want to thank you for your work on this issue. As a key Minnesota safety net hospital serving our state's sickest children, we believe it is critically important that we keep our safety net system as strong as possible. When one safety net hospital suffers, the system is weakened, and we all suffer. Although there's never a perfect solution, and this compromise is not perfect, we support this legislation that keeps a minimal safety net in place for our society's most vulnerable citizens. Although Children's receives no direct benefit from this legislation, we will be responsible for helping to pay for the solution. The elimination of supplemental disproportionate share payments after April 1st of 2010 included in this bill will cost Children approximately $6.4 million in anticipated funding.
As members know, this funding was put in place to ensure that providers who serve high levels of low-income patients are able to continue to provide care to those vulnerable people. At Children's, over 40% of our revenue comes from Medicaid, so this is a critical issue for us. These reductions in supplemental DSH are significant and they are cumulative. Taken together with reductions we've received in previous sessions, these cuts represent lost opportunities for us to invest in the health of our children. Mr. Chair, if I could take just a moment to remind the committee of the impact of medical assistance reductions on Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. We serve kids from every state, from every county in the state, so we are truly a statewide institution. We serve a highly diverse population of kids. We translate in over 40 languages and have over 50,000 interpreter encounters each year. And we serve a highly complex and sick population. More than half of our beds are critical care beds. We proudly serve more children covered under medical assistance than any provider in the state, and MA is Children's largest single revenue source. It accounted for over 40% of Children's revenue in 2009, up from just 28% a few years ago. This figure rose to 43% in January, so our reliance on Medicaid as a revenue source is substantial, and it is growing. To provide a comparison, our dependence on Medicaid is in contrast to an average adult acute care facility in Minnesota, which might average between 5 and 10%. So reductions to Medicaid hit Children's about four times as hard as they do adult facilities. We know that you will face difficult decisions in the coming days. The state's budget situation is challenging, and we recognize that you have a very hard task in front of you to confront this. As you go about your deliberations moving forward, we ask you to remember that because of the role we play in serving Minnesota's low-income children, most of whom are on medical assistance, budget decisions related to medical assistance disproportionately impact children to a greater degree than nearly any other hospital in the state. The compromise solution on JAMC, one we support, does disproportionately impact us, and this bill represents a substantial reduction in payment for us. We ask that you remember this as you move forward. Mr. Chair, in closing, let me say that the state made a decision long ago that investments in education were important because every child deserved the same opportunity to learn. Likewise, we firmly believe that every child in Minnesota should have a healthy start in life. The unfortunate truth is this. Further cuts will impact our ability to continue to invest in the health of Minnesota's kids. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Mr. Leitz? I don't see any. Thank you very much. And next is Mike Mahoney, and after him, I think the last person will be Ron Brand. Welcome to the committee, Mike.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, my name is Mike Mahoney. I'm Vice President of Public Policy for St. Mary's Duluth Clinic. At St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, our mission is we are here to serve patients. And I know that's a mission, Mr. Chairman, you share personally in your role chairing this committee. And Representative Murphy, I know that you take that to heart also, and that ranks very high in your priorities. And we thank both of you and the entire committee for grappling with this issue. We also find ourselves in a very unique situation, and we'd like to share a little bit of information regarding our environment and our service area as it relates specifically to this legislation. We supported the first GAMC fix, and we supported the second GAMC fix, but we have very strong reservations with this proposal. With me today is Kathy Von Ruden, also from St. Mary's Duluth Clinic, who has some comments to make from an operational perspective. And then if I could share with you the challenge that we're faced in the future decisions based on part of our system actually is eligible for CCO status, a significant component, a former county hospital that we assumed liability for, does not become eligible. And so we're faced with a significant challenge in a community, an area of the state that has two major systems. One would assume the responsibility for a population, and we're not quite sure what would happen in just down the street from us.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, my name is Kathy Von Ruden, and at SMDC I oversee the areas of reimbursement, health plan contracting, and billing. I had a chance to review the bill last night, and my main concern has to do with the two options that are available under the bill to SMDC. And both options would result in a significant and unfair financial risk. Our first option would be to agree to contract with the commissioner to become a coordinated care delivery system, as it's put in the bill, or more commonly called the CCO. As a CCO, we would take on an unrealistic and unfair amount of financial risk, as I said. The GAMC recipients would enroll or would be assigned to us. We serve a very large geographic area, and we would have a significant number of enrollees outside of our Duluth Health System hub, for example, on the range. With the fixed amount of dollars that we'd be allocated from the state, We'd have to cover not only SMDC's costs, our two main hospitals in Duluth and our 16 regional clinics. We'd also have to contract with non-SMDC system providers, and we would have to have a system to directly pay them, for example, on the range. We'd also have to contract and pay dentists directly because, according to the proposal, we would have to cover dental services. We'd be responsible for coordinating some social services such as housing. Of most concern to us is that for non-contracted facilities, we would have to cover under this fixed block grant all emergency services that take place at non-contracted facilities. A second option that we have is just not become a CCO. Then we would take all of our claims and we'd submit them to the temporary uncompensated care pool. And then after 6 months, the state would look at the dollars in the pool and the claims from all the non-CCOs or those qualified CCOs that would choose not to become a CCO and then split up the money proportionally. And we're not quite sure, of course, how much money each facility would receive. In the Twin Cities, there will probably be several CCOs, and they can all share the risk. But in northeastern Minnesota, SMDC would be bearing all of the risk for this GMC population.
And so based on this, currently, as the bill is, there's $2 million made available for St. Mary's Medical Center to become the CCO to serve the Arrowhead region. If we elect not to, of course, then we go into the pool that has $20 million available that goes statewide for everybody who doesn't seek CCO status. And those $2 million become available to other CCOs, of which the majority are in the metro area. And so we would be further subsidizing the metro area. A third of our business right now comes from Wisconsin and northern Michigan, so we pay the provider tax on a third of the services that we provide in Duluth. The degree to which we would be assuming risk puts us in jeopardy, basically. And we would very much appreciate the committee to take into account our situation, the fact that in the not-too-distant past, we did assume the public hospital in Duluth with all of its liability, and we would very much appreciate consideration of that fact to the point that the committee contemplate an amendment to the bill to add SMDC Medical Center, which is the former public hospital in Duluth, in the highest tier, together with identifying it as a non-state governmental hospital.
Okay, questions for Mr. Mahoney or Ms. Van Ruden? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, we do, you know, realize that you are in a very unique situation in Duluth, and that was brought to our attention, and we'll continue to look at this and move forward, but we do realize the unique nature of your situation in Duluth, and we'll hopefully look forward to working together and trying to work out a solution.
Thank you.
And Mike, I know about the amendment, and I just did not feel it would be appropriate for me to offer that here, but when we get to the Finance Committee, it may reappear.
I respect that. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And is Mr. Brand here? And you're going to have to be real quick because okay. We have to vote in about 4 minutes.
All right, I'll go quickly. For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Ron Brand. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, which is a statewide organization that provides clinic services, psychiatry and mental health clinic services, as well as a variety of home and community-based and residential services. I appreciate the incredible effort that has gone into trying to find a solution to this unbearable problem, and I'm in awe of the heart and the intelligence that you all brought to the task. In order to understand this point of view that we bring to this, we represent a substantial majority of the outpatient or non-hospital-based mental health services. It's also important to understand that our member organizations provide a combination of services because people who have more serious mental illnesses need a combination of psychiatry, medications, social supports, and things like that. We work with this population currently. There, in 2008, for example, there were 16,500 non-hospital clients that were involved with receiving community mental health services. The spending on that was about $15.5 million. Which was about 12% of the overall spending in GAMC. So when I look at this bill and the struggle that we've had over the last bit, most of the services, most of the money is going to pay for medical surgical care, even though 70% of the people have mental health or substance abuse type problems. To give you some examples of specific impacts on our programs, Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center in the Rochester area reports $750,000 of losses for psychiatry, therapy, and their residential ERTS program. Spectrum Mental Health in Minneapolis reports that the GMC loss would be $650,000, mostly for their intensive case management program that they provide. Range Mental Health Center talked about how over 30% of the people in their ERTS are GAMC, which would cause them to lose $100,000. In addition to that, they have another $130,000 worth of psychiatry and other services that they provide. HDC in the St. Louis County Duluth area is going to be losing around $250,000. Much of it is psychiatry, but also some of the intensive case management services. Guild Incorporated, which serves the Dakota County area and some in Ramsey County and has a wonderful partnership with Regents Hospital, will lose $322,000 associated with this program. We're Lakeland Mental Health Center in the Fergus Falls, Moorhead, Detroit Lakes area will lose $430,000, mostly for their crisis services and their psychiatry outpatient clinic services. People Incorporated here in the Twin Cities reports that 30% of the people who are in their crisis residential stabilization program are on GAMC. We asked them to look at each of those cases to determine whether or not those people would meet inpatient admission criteria, and almost 90% of the people in their upon review would have met inpatient of the 1,200 people. About 90% of them would have met inpatient criteria, but that program will be unfunded in this proposal. So it's very hard. On one hand, we can see the way in which this proposal would impact outpatient and non-hospital-based services, yet we also know that people who are living with serious mental illnesses have other health conditions for which they need medical surgical care, and it's quite a dilemma for us. The ECP concept that's in the bill is an important one and it's useful. You should be aware, however, that the current enrollees as designated as ECPs and the community mental health centers and the community health centers don't line up perfectly well because many of the organizations have dropped their enrollment with that over the last several years. The concept is good and I think we can work with it, but it is... We just know that there are concerns about having how the coordinated care organizations and the outpatient and non-hospital-based services will interact. It will be administratively complex. Will money go in but not come out of the hospitals? Will there be shifting of clients, patients from one type of provider to another? There's a provision in the bill that says that providers who participate in the coordinated care organizations cannot refuse services to people. One of the problems we have is that on one hand we may have a program that goes and helps with discharge planning at the hospital or might help divert people from the ER, which may be very desirable to be part of the coordinated care organization, but the psychiatry and outpatient services that work hand in glove for that may not be. And so how do we keep the psychiatry and the outpatient programs alive if we must take all GAMC clients because another part of the organization participates? So the impact of this may be on specific programs and services in a disproportionate way, and some of them will simply just no longer be viable. Our organizations will have to make business decisions about who they can serve and whether or not some of those programs will be able to continue despite the cost effectiveness that you that can be easily demonstrated by any of our health plans that work with us and many of the others. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brand, and we do not have time for any questions. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I think my committee is coming in here next, and I'll waive a little bit of its time.
Okay, good, thank you. And the reason for...
Because I want to say something.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to tell the members the reason for this rush is that the Department of Human Services was in the process of automatically enrolling people in Minnesota Care from GAMC, and they have agreed to stop that for a brief period of time. It costs a lot of money, actually, to do that, and they're waiting on us to get this bill passed as fast as possible. So, Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to say a couple of things, and this is a very difficult bill for me, and I know for a lot of others. First, when the administration comes up and calls this a step forward, I don't think for anybody else in this room this is a step forward. It's a step forward maybe from the administration's perspective because they were going to zero out this program. But in no other world can that be conceived as a step forward. The second thing is, we voted a bill off the floor that was a difficult vote, 125-9. That wasn't even a perfect solution. We brought it up for a veto override, and the excuse given for not voting the way people had voted before was that we thought we were going to go to conference committee. I can't imagine in any world people believe that the conference committee would have come back with a bill that was $100 million less money than the bill that passed off the floor. You know, we've heard a lot of testimony here today that this bill is better than nothing. And I'm not sure that better than nothing is really good enough at this point. And so, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do in terms of voting for it as we move down the line. But I just think we could have done better.
Other comments? Seeing none, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think... you can now know why I'm not sure if I'm a saint or a sinner after this. But practicing nursing and taking care of patients taught me how to do difficult things in order to achieve an objective, and I think this represents that discipline for me and probably for others as well. And so I ask for your support with respect. Thank you.
Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 802 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance, referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The bill passes. Thank you, Representative Murphy, for your phenomenal,
as amended,
yes, for your phenomenal amount of work, and the meeting is adjourned.